Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, it's Marcia Cook, and we are on A Good Story is a Good Story, and we have a new show that we're having. This is the first one with Sam Oliver, and I'm going to let Sam tell you a little bit about himself, too, but this is a question and answer. This is the first time we've done this, and we do have questions that people have asked us already, and this is what we'll be doing on this show, and we have producing the show is Sandra Elrod. Sandra, are you here? Hello.
I'm here, Marcia.
And then we have Bennett Pomerantz, who popped in to join the conversation. And hi, Bennett.
Hi there.
And we have Sam that is here. Hi, Sam Oliver. Sam's been on my show just as a guest, but now he's the co-host now because this is his time. And I'm going to let Sam tell you a little bit about himself. But let's see. I think we won't give the... Maybe we should give it now. I probably should do this because we never get a chance to do this. I think I'd better tell you probably some of the info now because once we get into this discussion, I know we're not going to want to get out of it. So tomorrow we don't have a show, but we do have a show on Friday, okay, with Bonnie Trachtenberg, and it's going to be really a great show. And it's going to be on at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. It's Central and 11 a.m. Mountain. And she wrote a book, Wedlocked, but she was a senior staff writer at Bookspan. She did Doubleday Books. She's really interesting. She's got a good book, and she's going to join in a conversation with Virginia and myself. And we had her on for another day, but we decided to do this because we do not know if we're going to have our Friday show in the afternoon anymore. So we are just doing this show as a good story on Friday. And that should be fun. And then next Tuesday night, we're having Barbara Watkins and Candace O'Donnell. And it's Hollowing Screams is her book. And it should be really interesting. And Candace will be on. And Candace is a psychic, and she's a writer. She's great. And she had her own show. So that should be fun. All right, now that we've done that, okay, now I'm going to let Sam introduce himself. But first I'm going to let Bennett for a second. So, and Sandra, I'll introduce. Sandra is producing the show. She also does book reviews. She does a lot of contests. She's the judge of contests. She also writes, and she's got a good career ahead of herself. And Sandra, we love having you here, and she works with Fran Lewis on Fran's show. So hi, we'll say hi to Sandra.
Hi, everybody. I'm glad to be here.
And if there's any calls, whatever, we'll take them. You know, Sandra will be helping taking them. Okay, and Bennett, we'll let you say exactly who you are, so I don't... Who are you, Bennett?
I'm an author, Loving Hearts Live Forever. I also have my To Be or What column. I have a column in Night Owl. I also write for Amazon, Audio World, Affaire Decor. I don't do anything. I'm lazy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I tend to be a reviewer. I also tend to... Speak My Mind. My To Be or What column has gotten some awards lately. Very nice stuff. And my memoirs will be out at the end of this year. End of 2012, sorry. And just having a great time.
And he joins us when he thinks the timing is good. So, Sam, he wants to be on this show tonight. So there he is. Okay, and Sam has been on my show many times, and he's written a lot of books, and he's written Angel Marie, that is a wonderfully sweet, very good book. And I want you to talk a little bit about yourself and say what you want to do with the show, because he is the co-host, and this is his show, and I'm here just here. I'm just here because I'm here, I guess. Okay, Sam, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm excited about being on this show. I've worked for a hospice almost 22 years now, and I've done quite a bit of studies in my writing field, and I've written for over a decade for three national hospice journals. I did that for quite some time, and decided to start writing books. My first book is What the Dying Teach Us, and the subtitle is Lessons on Living. But here lately, I moved from after doing those first five books to moving from writing teaching books on death and dying, all the way from children's books to adult books, to writing fictional books on angels. And in each one of my stories, I don't know how long this path will be for me. All I know is that I keep wanting and keep being inspired to write another book on angels. I'm actually writing about one particular person in particular, Angel of Promise. There is a angel named Promise on the internet. If you'll take a look at him, the Angel of Things. He comes to people in their hour of need and helps to transform who they are and helps them to remember who they are, helps them to remember the angel that is inside of them. I feel like that's a lot of what I've tried to do in all of my books, is to inspire a sense of hope and help people to remember their eternal nature within them. And I've studied in seminary. I went to seminary and graduated, been ordained in a couple of denominations, but I really believe that where I've really learned how to do ministry is the work that I do with the dying. And to be honest with you, it is work, but the work is letting go of what I think needs to be done to listen to that inner voice that the patients are telling me through their stories, to allow me to work with their unique spiritual path that allows them to remember and find that place inside themselves that'll lead their soul to a place where they can feel free once again in the midst of their dying. That is the work that I feel like that I'm called to do and feel like I enjoy doing with others and would like to share on this show. I'm free to entertain questions all the way from angels, anything on metaphysics, a little bit of science, of course, religion, spirituality, and anything on healing. I studied for about 10 years with a healer from India. A lot about healing technique, and I try to incorporate that in everything that I do. So that's a little bit about myself.
That's great. That's great, because this is a good thing, because we all know that everybody needs hope. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, when I first met you and we talked to them, I mean, that's what, at any point in our life, even at the darkest of moments, we still have to feel there's some hope. And that's what you bring to the conversation always. And you tell us all these interesting things. And some of the things that you've said in the past to me, I just keep with me in my head, because it does help you in times of need. So we do have a couple questions. I don't know if, Bennett, do you want to ask? I mean, I know you're here, though, so you might want to ask a question before I do.
I do. I'd rather you guys start, and because
okay,
there are a couple
right,
things.
Okay.
I don't want to get in the middle of something.
Okay,
I want Sam to have his spot that moment.
Okay.
Then we'll talk a little about religion
okay.
and things like that that interest me.
Okay. All right. So, well, I think we have a question, and this was from Fran Lewis, and she usually goes to bed early, and she's a very good book reviewer, and we've done a lot of shows together, and Sam knows Fran, and Sandra knows Fran because she was with her on her show, but she can't usually stay up late at night. For her, this is late, okay, and so because she's up at 2 in the morning. So she wanted to know a couple things, but one of them that she really wanted to know was, what role does the chaplain play when you're dealing with the family members in the hospital when a loved one is in palliative care? And what do you say to them, and how do you comfort them? What do you do?
Well, I first start out by inquiring a little bit about their religion to see if they have one at all, and if they don't, that's fine. There's a lot of people these days that do not have one, but what I'm mainly interested in is finding out a little bit about their story. Because when they start telling me a little bit about their life, they're going to start revealing to me things that are meaningful to them. And those meaningful moments that are in their lives give them the opportunity to express with great emotion and with great mental clarity oftentimes the expression of their life that has literally inspired them or infused them with spirit and gave them a great deal of strength during those moments in their lives. And what they're usually telling me in those stories is usually a theme of something, a spiritual theme will pop up from that, which tells me a little bit about the spiritual strength that they have inside of them. And then start building on those strengths that they have as they are being told that they no longer are going to be able to live very much longer because really those inspired strengths that are inside of them would not only give them the strength to embrace a path that their ego doesn't want to embrace, but it will help them to remember who they are and give their heart an ability to experience what is often talked about as that peace in the midst of despair that a lot of times religious circles will talk about. But I'm not sure a lot of religious circles talk about it in terms of anything more or less than a faith in a particular way of believing that the church has taught them. But the way I'm talking about it is that those inspired themes that are inside of a person's heart and soul that are the unique gifts that they brought into the world. But it's those same strengths that will allow them to close their eyes to the world around them and open them up into that place where they can experience life once again. See, one of the things we don't often think of, and it's very, very simple experiences of our lives that we often don't pay attention to. When we were born into the world, we had a little infant body. We got a little older, and we had a child's body, and a teenager's body, an adult's body, and a mature body, and we have a dying body. The interesting thing about every one of those bodies is that we've survived the death of every one of them.
So are you saying that every different phase of our life, just as you let it go, it's like just a part of how we get to the part where we're going to die?
What I want to refer to is all of those strengths, those inner strengths that lie within us, allow us to be consumed by life, literally, the body that we held in those moments. And in order for us to embrace another form or another life that is ahead of us, which often comes with much pain and sorrow and heartbreak, because no teenager, a lot of times, if they're honest with themselves, because I remember that moment when I had to let go of my parents' security and move on into adulthood. We don't ever want to let go of any of those experiences because it means letting go of a whole lifetime that we have built and gave incredible meaning and power to. And we've got to let it, all of it, go. We've got to die to all of it in order to embrace
whatever the phase is that they're in at the time. Yeah, I guess that, yeah. Mm-hmm. I never thought about it in that way, but that's probably right. I mean, because maybe that's why people really, when they're at weddings, they do cry, because maybe you are looking at that person and seeing them as they grew up, and then they're moving on to a whole different life.
Yeah, there may be people in the crowd that's actually crying because they don't get a chance to date that person, too. They're letting go.
Yeah.
We're all letting go of something at all times and all phases of our life. And it's something that the soul naturally knows how to do. Now, what I mean about soul is that place where you see through your eyes what you no longer can see with them. And I want to put it in a simple term here, or a simple explanation, what I mean by soul and seeing through your eyes what you can't see with them. See, when we throw a pebble or a rock into a lake or a pond, we may actually be able to see it wiggle its way into the water a little bit if it's clear water. But there comes a point where you no longer can see where that rock is going. And then at that moment, when you can no longer see where it's going, there's something inside of us that kicks in that just knows exactly where that rock went to. It went to the very bottom where the bottom of that water of what holds every bit of that water up. And there's no way you can see it with your physical eye, but we know it through the inner eyes or the inner vision that we have inside of us that allows us to literally, if you pay close attention, you may even be able to become one with that rock and feel the fluid of the water and become one with the rock till you reach that bottom and feel that settledness that we finally settle into. And that place that holds every bit of life up is what is often known as the soul or spirit.
You know, I have a question here that somebody wanted to know. They want to know is they don't believe in DNRs, and they want to know how some ways to help a family member understand what is happening and be able to make the right decision if they don't believe in DNRs. And do they, I mean, how do they get to the time and when they can make that decision of, yes, I think it's time to not give any more treatment, you know, because a lot of people, I guess, don't believe in DNRs. I do believe, you know, I believe that sometimes you, as much as you don't want to lose the person, you just have to do what the right thing might be that you think. So how do people come to that decision that sometimes they don't want to do? I mean, what happens when the doctors say, I think it's time, and then the family members say, I don't want to do this? How? What do you say to them? Because they're probably asking you, I would assume.
They do. They do. And I listen oftentimes for quite a long time to them talk about the reasons why they love that person, and that's why they don't want to let go. And even though there's a part of them that knows that it's usually a machine that's taking, helping them breathe every breath they take through their natural body doing it for them, oftentimes that's what happens in the hospital. But there's other case scenarios, but that's one I'm going to use right now. But when the body is no longer able to sustain itself, to me, and from the way I look at that, is that the soul is telling you it's time to move into another form or formless state. We don't know what's ahead of us. All we know is about the human experiences where we die to a baby form and become a child. We know that through experience. But there's a part of us that doesn't even feel as though we have aged at all. That's soul, and the soulful part of us that I often refer to as the spiritual or the awareness of consciousness. Any of those terms, it's all talking about the same thing. When you talk about being confined, when that awareness is confined to a painful body, such as people who are making a very difficult decision in releasing someone, well, believe me, those who are making that difficult decision and holding on to what no longer is alive and well and going to live freely, they're in as much pain as the one who has probably, if we're talking about life support, who has already died.
Yeah. So on life support, then they are already gone, and then the person.
They are already gone if they're on life support. A lot of times doctors give people time to accept it is what's going on. If there's no brain activity, the body's not functioning. Let me share a little bit about the energetic body here.
Okay.
When the body, when it begins to no longer be able to urinate or any kind of bowel movement or not take in any food, it usually means that person is within 3 to 5 days of dying. Because if there's nothing coming out of it, mm-hmm. Then you're not taking anything in. You're not taking any food in to sustain you either as well. But that means that the body is not functioning. You know, Time Magazine wrote an interesting article a few years ago about the 7 energy systems in the body. In India, they talk about it as a 7 chakra system. I'll just briefly go over them. There's the root chakra, what grounds you. Then there's the illumination. There's the creativity. There's the heart. There is the will, and then there is the psychological or psyche, and then there's the spirit. When your energy moves up the body, and a lot of times when someone is dying or actively dying, their feet start to get cold. They'll turn purple, or they'll turn very white, but it's very cold, and it'll move up the body. The last, and as long as a person's physical body is moving, and they can move their arms or something, they still can be in the dying process, but they're still moving. Their left brain activity is working. That's the left and right hemispheres of the brain. The left controls the physical body. The right is oftentimes what Time Magazine talks about as being the seat of soul, where the creative imagination, where the soul takes flight at the end of someone's dying process. And I think they're using correct words. When the left brain still has a lot of physical activity, you can actually feel this if you put your hand over a person's body. and their brain. You can actually feel where
on their forehead. You mean on your the forehead you would touch, or the forehead?
You can move your hand from the bottom of their feet all the way to the top of their head. And then when you know they're close and they're no longer moving their physical body anymore, if they're no longer moving their physical body, you're probably going to feel just a lot of activity on the right side of the brain. And they talk about that being a place where life reviews are played out.
Mm-hmm.
And but you will often see when the physical body is no longer moving, and yet a person still has activity on the left side of their brain. If you will notice, they usually have a stare or a blank stare, maybe looking through you or looking at an object in the room, and then it'll get glossy or glassy to where you don't feel as though they're looking at anything. Well, they've probably gone so far, so deep inside themselves that none of us in the room can follow them to that place. The only thing you can be able to notice and be able to feel at that point is that there is a stillness going on there within the body. And it's where we all go to when we're contemplating something in our life or the next move in our life. We actually go to a very similar place when we do that anyway. It's the creative imagination. It's the place where the right brain function enables us to transform or become a different form or a different idea of who we want to become at the next phase of our life.
Yeah.
That's a little bit about it.
Yeah, no, these are questions that people want to know because this is, unfortunately, we've all gone through it or will go through this, and, sometimes you don't know what to do.
Well, a lot of times, though, in facing the DNR status, those who are making that decision, if the loved one who is going is not able to make it for themselves, they're really taking a look, hopefully, in what's in the best interest of the patient. And I do know this, people who do have power of attorney and who have, legal rights over someone who or can make the decision for someone, the doctors will be patient enough, and they don't tell you this, but they'll be patient enough to see if that caregiver is going to come along and do the right thing.
Right.
If they don't do the right thing and allow something to linger on, the doctor won't override it because then you're looking at possible lawsuits, which really is a waste of time and money for everyone because hospitals have a lot of money to lock up things in for years, and it's not worth your time or money to try to do it. But they'll be patient for a while. But then there comes a time where if they really can't reason through it, then you're really looking at a caregiver who may not be mentally competent enough to make the right decision in what's best for that person.
It's a hard decision, for whoever has to do it. But what you're saying is, though, when you realize that and they tell you that this is it, then there's no coming back. I think everybody would like to believe that, yes, all of a sudden there's going to be a miracle and they're going to come back, but that doesn't really happen. And
Miracles don't happen that easy.
Yeah, right. It's exactly right. And, and I think that that's probably what people feel. They just are waiting to see that, maybe the patient will come to life again, but that isn't the case. So what you're saying is the doctors are patient to a point, but then they realize that something has to be done because you're saying that the patient actually is making the decision because they've stopped functioning.
Right. Yeah, the patient tells you what.
That's kind of a good way to look at it, though. Yeah, it's kind of a better way to look at it in some ways because you're saying that once they're in that position, you already know that you're doing the right thing because that's what the patient wants. They're done. They've had enough of life, and that's it.
Well, if the patient wanted to live, or if there was a chance they were going to live, they wouldn't be
in
without
that state.
Function.
Okay, thank you. That's very interesting.
And no one should feel guilty about making the decision to pull the plug on something that their loved one has already made a decision long before they make the choice. You know what they're making a choice for? They're only making a choice to end a mechanical
Right. So what you're saying is they're not even the person that has to say that has to say it's okay now, they can go. They really aren't making the choice. The patient did it, so that they're just saying okay for the hospital, so they have all their because so nobody gets sued along the way. You know, because it's all about lawsuits. That's the thing. So, you know, but there is a point where they're not going to let you just, you know, I mean, you can't do anything without the family probably telling you so, I would assume. Now it's very hard to do anything without, and you have to have a power of attorney for health to do it anyway,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. One thing I know after I didn't mention that I have chaired ethics committee for over 10 years too as well in my life, and one thing that is, autonomy is number one in the patient, and that patient's autonomy will come first, even if they have to remove someone from not being able to make the right decision. That person's autonomy in their life to be able to make their choice, and their choice has already been decided if they chose to let go, and it will be made for everyone else. It's really not as complicated as sometimes people make it sound. But we really sometimes become unreasonable because our egos get involved, or we want that miracle that we think can happen. But that then again, if you listen to that, that's a person's ego and trying to control the world that cannot be controlled.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sandra, did you want to ask something?
No.
Okay. Well, another question that somebody had asked me, and I put it down here. It says if you already are cremated and your ashes and you have your ashes and they're in an urn, and they're not spread, you know, wherever that they want to. Is the person in an unrested state, or are they? How long can someone be in ashes, or can they just stay there, or should they be scattered?
I'm trying to figure out the question in that.
The question is if a person dies and they are cremated, and then you give someone an urn, okay, and has the ashes in it. If the ashes are not spread out in a place, is the person like not at a restful state, their soul. Is their soul not? This was a question from somebody else.
This is religious idealism, Marcia. That I could chime in. I'd rather hear Sam first, but
okay.
I think he and I are going to have a debate on this. Go ahead, Sam.
Well, I'm going to say one thing religiously first. The Bible talks about things being from ashes to ashes, dust to dust, we return.
Right.
That person has already gone, and, you know, and that person's already gone the moment they breathe their life out. You know, we come into the world every single time we breathe in as a baby.
Mm-hmm.
When you die, every single time you breathe out. Now, if you pay attention or notice and feel what's going on in that room, you're going to feel an incredible peace for that person's soul. Because, for one, that soul is no longer in a painful body that it can no longer exist in freely and live and move and have its being. And as far as I'm concerned, we're all energy. We're all spirit.
This was not exactly my question, but this was somebody had asked me about this. But what I, you know, is, like, sometimes you hear certain things, you go, the soul doesn't rest.
The soul is gone. The soul.
Right. Okay.
I'm sorry.
All right.
The soul is not. Has nothing to do with the ash.
Okay. All right.
The ashes.
We really need to think of it in terms of the soul is what creates the body, not the other way around.
Okay.
The body doesn't create the soul. The soul is eternal. That's the part of our awareness that lives through the death of several bodies in a lifetime, different vehicles that we live in. And the ashes has nothing to do. It doesn't matter.
Okay, all right.
You know,
somebody had asked me that, but I don't know the answer to it. Right, this is not my territory. I know when it's my territory, and it's not. So this is that's why I'm asking you, you know, because I don't know this, and they asked me this question. And so then all right, so then we've got that answer then. I could see what that answer is.
Ashes are a lifeless form, Marcia.
Yes.
The soul has already gone to limbo, gone to heaven, gone to another in the realm of the universe, depending on what your theory is. The ashes are just the remains. It's like burying a coffin. The person is down 6 feet under. The ashes are just a burnt part of that person. Some people are weird. They want to keep the ashes on a shelf and look at them every 5 minutes under their portrait or whatever. The soul is gone, but the person in their mind still lives on. Some people bury the ashes in Forest Glen. That's great. You can go to Forest Glen and visit the ashes. Marilyn Monroe's ashes are there. So does that mean that she's dead? Oh, yeah, she's gone. But her ashes are there.
When the person asked that, I think they just wanted to know if sometimes people feel that the soul, that they're not in rest. I don't know. I've heard this, you know, myself. I don't know either. But, you know, they say the soul isn't rested. But I guess what I'm listening to right now answers that question.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sam.
I guess there's so many ways that people look at things, I would assume.
Well, I want to say this as clear as I can. The ashes, it doesn't matter, and I don't mean to be disrespectful. I am not when I say that, because I am more respectful of the soul than I am the body. It doesn't matter what we do with the ashes.
Okay.
When you talk to a person, the part that you really connect to is what's inside them. If they are sick, then you're talking to a sick person, and the body looks sick because something is sick inside that person. There's dis-ease in the body, or disease that we talk about. That dis-ease is the soul in unrest, because something's not working well in the body. And usually what's not working well is something not working well in life. It's usually because doctors will tell you stress causes all kinds of stuff, all kinds of ailments in every one of us.
As I said, this was not my expertise, but this was a question somebody had asked. So I, you know, I'm just asking what, because I know they want to know the answer to that one.
You know, one of the things that I've every once in a while will say to people, the things in life that really matter are the things in life that isn't matter. Keep that in mind, and we'll remember who we are. And
I agree with that. I know it doesn't matter. Right, things that matter. Right, I know what you're saying. I understand that. And you know, there are a lot of people that don't live that way. But that's probably the best way to live. You know, right, to look at it that way. It's a better.
Okay, Marcia, think of it this way. The Bible says that man's supposed to live to 70 years, 70 years. Okay? The life mortality in the early 1900s was 52. Okay, we have surpassed that 52 by using all the medical ease that we have now, that we've made the body and the soul and the mind live ahead to people in their 80s and 90s. So we've surpassed ourselves 30 years with a mortality table from early 1900s to 2000s. Okay? But still, you hear, okay, and I'm not trying to be morbid, but Jack Webb, who had a lovely career, died at 59, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Joe Flynn, he died at 59, but he died of an accident. But still, these people have full life, and sometimes we don't look as they've had a full life.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you, Marcia?
Sam, what do you think about that?
Well, we used to die in our 50s. And if you leave the body into it, even now, if we were to not give people medicine, most of us would live and be close to 50, maybe die in their 40s. And there's a lot of people with a lot of stress in their life that would die in their 30s, maybe even earlier. There's people who have heart attacks in their 20s anymore.
Right. I actually had a show on that like last year and for the National Heart Month, and they were discussing that, and there were two people that actually worked in a hospital that had heart attacks right there. They were in their 30s, and it wasn't expected, but luckily they were in the hospital working. They were, you know, they were nurses, whatever, and they were, luckily they were safe. But that's true. People don't think that in their 30s that they can have a heart attack, but that is true. People, you know, nobody wants to believe that that's true, but that is true.
But you know, take a look at what allows people to live into their 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
It's usually some kind of medical pill or some kind of vibrational medical surgery, or we cut something out. But even then, we try to radiate it, or we try to use radiation or some kind of vibrational medicine in order to cut something out of us that is causing disease or dysfunction in the body. And we use medicine, which is basically infused with chemical energy as well as herbal energy. And some people go to holistic doctors and cut out the infusion of any kind of chemistry and just keep it on the level of herbal or energetic medicine. When we do extend the life of someone else, look at what we use. We use energy. You can call it soul, you can call it spirit, or you can call it life. It's what gives us and sustains us in life. When people, I really just think a lot of people, if they would just get creative in life, I don't care if they can make a living at it or not, just find what your creative talent is. And if you can find what you came to create within the world, you will ground yourself and connect to the world in a way that not only infuses the world like a shot does inside of a body with energy, with your energy you came to give to it, it will give something back to you. It will sustain you.
Well, that's interesting that you said that, because I think 2 weeks ago, and Sandra and I were just talking about that before, I had Michael Davis was on my show, and he was talking about he had had cancer, and he is a very good writer, and he's written a lot of books, and he said now at the point, and he's actually got a video, so you want to write, you know, that's, I don't think it's out yet, but that's what he was talking about. But what he did say, which was interesting, is he said now at this point in his life that he has recovered, thank goodness, and he said that he's writing because he loves to write, and whoever buys his book, and he's happy for that, and he's not going to, like, because I think we were talking about the subject that everybody is just on Facebook, on Twitter, everybody's trying to do the PR, they're not even enjoying writing anymore. I've heard people giving up writing now because they're so sick of doing all the PR, and here's this man who had cancer, and he said, you know what, I'm just writing because I love it, and I'm liking my stories, and I hope people will like my stories, and that, I mean, sometimes somebody says something and it keeps in your head, and that was something that keeps in my head now because I'm listening to all these people now. Everybody's so busy, stressed out, doing PR, doing this, unhappy about this, and here's a man who went through everything, for he had really a horrible time of it, and then he's, you know, survived it, and he's saying, just enjoy what you do, and that's basically what you're saying now. If you're creative, just create. Don't keep worrying about everything else. Just do what you
like. Exactly.
And I think a lot of people have forgotten that because, as you know, what happened with Facebook last week, on the Sun-Times in Chicago, this is what's happened. In the paper was people are stressed because of Facebook. So I'm thinking to myself, what is happening here? Okay, and I actually was one of those people because I couldn't figure out, I thought it's me. I thought, what is going on? Every time I'm doing something else, it changed it, Facebook changed it, took it off, put it on, and I'm staying up, it's 3, 4 in the morning, I'm thinking, like, this is crazy. And if the headline of the Sun-Times paper in Chicago is, Facebook is making you stressed, there's something wrong here. Okay, then I'm really trying to figure this out in my own head because I know what I've been doing, you know, trying to PR and do everything, and, you know, you can't do everything. You have to find, like you're saying, find what you like and do it.
Right. Well, if you're doing something you enjoy, let's separate that just a little bit. Then you will find yourself in joy. And
right.
If you find yourself in joy, the body tends to function far much better whenever it's in a happy state than any other state.
Well, Dennis Watley wrote The Joy of Working. I don't know if you remember it, but he said if you're enjoying your job, anything else doesn't matter, because if you're enjoying your job, you can go to work every day and feel happy. And if you're not, get out of your job and find one that does make you happy.
I cannot tell you how much I agree with that, because there's a lot of people who make a lot of money and they end up losing it because they're doing a job they hate, and they end up spending as much in health care costs as they did to make the money.
And you see the people, right? And you see them.
It's just Yeah, yeah. It's a cycle that just never ends. And I do know what that means because I've done this for almost 22 years and working with people who are dying. I actually can't believe I get paid for something I enjoy doing. I actually get paid for helping people talk about their life and tell their story.
Well, that's a good thing, though. I mean, that's a good thing to have. You know, like what you said, it doesn't matter what religion, because when you're in the hospital and you're talking, you know, and whoever you're visiting or whoever is not doing well and you need to talk to somebody, at that particular time, I don't think it makes a difference. You need of someone that is friendly, someone that is kind, and someone that will help you. And that is you. So that I think the people that are very lucky that are at the hospital you're at, because a lot of times it doesn't always happen that way. And so that's a good thing that you do, because that is what people need at that time. They need to talk to somebody that will understand. And, you know, I had a question here from somebody that they wrote in that they want to know why some doctors are hardened to death. So when they talk to a doctor, they say, well, you know, they just walk out of the room, or they want to not talk about it, and they just leave you alone sometimes. And that's sometimes if a person is feeling alone and the patient they're visiting is not able to talk to them, there they sit and they're looking and they don't know who to talk to. Do you find that some of the doctors are so hardened to death, or some are not hardened where they'll actually sit and talk to the, you know, the family for a few minutes?
Well, you know, I do think there are... They know the process so well that they don't think about it, and they know what's going to inevitably happen. I've talked to doctors who are dying, and some want to talk about it, and others they know what's going to happen, so they don't feel like they need to talk about it.
Oh, I see.
But I look at it like any other job. There's people who go to it for the money, and those who do it because they love it. And I know of some doctors, you won't see them outside of the hospital, and they may go home and kind of bury themselves or try to hide away from everyone else. And then there are other doctors who will give you their cell phone number, and they'll tell you, if something's wrong, I'll meet you at the hospital myself. I'm not going to have another doctor take care of you but me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just there's in any profession, I really think it's wonderful that anyone goes into the medical profession, and I'm amazed that anyone finishes a doctor's degree.
Well, Sandra is a nurse. Sandra's a nurse, Sandra?
Yes.
Do you have anything to say about, you know, because you're a nurse. I mean, and you know, we had talked about the fact that sometimes people say they shouldn't go to nursing homes because there's nobody there with the patient. But Sandra, maybe you should just say what you did when you were a nurse to help some of these people in nursing homes, because you were in one helping people. So people realize that nursing homes are not the worst thing.
They are.
I was the assistant director of nurses at the nursing homes that I worked at. And if we had anyone in the dying process, I always had someone assigned to be with that patient. We always looked after their family's needs, made sure they had refreshments, a place to stay there if they wanted to stay with their loved one. We always made sure there was music playing in the background and someone talked to that person, even if they couldn't respond.
That's good to know, because, you know, because some people say, oh, they don't want to put, you know, their loved one in a nursing home. They're not going to get any care. So you're saying right now that you at least you gave care. And my mother was in a nursing home for a while, and I can't say I was there every day. She lived with me for a while, but I did trust the nursing home that she was in, and I was there, and I visited her every day. They took care of her, and I watched them, and they were very nice to patients. So, and you as a nurse are saying that. In your case,
we treated our residents the way we would want us or our family members to be treated if we were in that situation.
Well, I have a different story, but of course, mine was when I went to a nursing home because I had a medical. I was rehabbing on a not physical. I had hurt myself, so I had to have rehab and physical rehabilitation, and not. I was not dying, and I still am not dying. Well, we're all dying, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
I was rehabbing, and it was not on drugs or anything else. I love when somebody says, you're rehabbing, you've been on drugs. No, I had an ailment, and I had to have physical therapy and things like that. I couldn't have physical therapy in my home.
Right. No, right, right. Yeah.
and my condition was that dire that they needed to put me someplace to do that. And the nurses had very little care. There were some nurses that cared, and some opens your door and yells, "Peters!" at 2 in the morning and 3 in the morning. I'm like, I'm sorry, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm sleeping, don't wake me.
Right.
I had a nurse, I have a bad foot, and I was taking a break, and I had my door closed. She just opened the door, walked in, she sees I was on the toilet, and walks right out. No, oops, sorry, you know, nothing. So, I mean, I was the youngest senior citizen in the Jewish home in Rockville. So, you know, to me, that was, and I'm not a senior citizen, but that's how I was treated. I was, you know, people also, I loved how they treated you like you were deaf. They, at the top of their lungs, said, "Mr. Pomerant," at the top of their lungs. I said, "I'm not deaf." And then they slowed down their words and said, "Mr. Pomerant." I said, "I'm not mentally incompetent either. I can hear you fine."
But
well,
that could be in a hospital, too. It all depends on where
you are. Oh, it's happened
in
hospitals, too. Right. But, you know, I'm not trying to fault the health care or the medical care. We're talking more of the dying, and I think some of these nurses, and I'm not saying, oh, please don't kill me, Sandra, but some of these nurses need to have they need to sit in the other place for a few minutes and see what's going on. There was a great movie called The Doctor, where this doctor had throat cancer.
And William Hurt? I talk about William Hurt. That was a wonderful movie.
And he basically was suddenly the patient. He had no choices. And suddenly he realized what was going on. So what he did was he took his students, when he finally recovered, took his students and had them live as a patient for a day or two.
Yeah.
So they knew how to be on the other side. And sometimes the nurses, I think in some of the facilities I've seen, should live on the other side for a minute instead of trying to wake up somebody in the middle of the night and yell pills and they're trying to sleep or something.
Yeah. Sam, so
a lot of mine may have came from my nurses' training. We were taught that way. We had to feed each other. We had to give each other shots and take care of each other. In nursing school.
That's good.
Yeah.
Hopefully, that's a good way to. Right, that's a good thing.
We had to blindfold each other and be blind for a day or deaf for a day.
Yeah, see, that's interesting. See, then you would know how to do this. Sam, do you find that in the hospitals, or do you find that the care, you know, that they're giving is better, or could use some help, or?
Well, it just depends on the person. It's always the person.
Right.
There's not. I don't think there's bad institutions. There's just bad and good people in them.
Right.
And but
I
one
agree.
Thing I would like to point out is that I do think when it comes to the dying process that I've learned over the years that it's probably more of a spiritual experience than a physical one. Yes, we use medicine to be able to bring peace to the body, but it's really the presence of the caregiver that comes into the room to be with the patient that the patient oftentimes will respond to. I notice over the years, I noticed my voice has become quieter and softer, and so is my heart. Because when you experience life and you experience the joys and sorrows of it, you mellow out, you experience more unconditional love for yourself, so you want to give it to everyone, you see. And people respond to that like medicine. I've walked into a patient's room where they may be in a great deal of pain, and before their medicine can work, they will motion me over to the bed if they know me. And they'll want me to hold their hand, and they'll squeeze it tight. It doesn't make their pain any less, but there's something about having someone there that they trust or they feel is a presence of peace that does something for them. Now, I will say this. There are some healing techniques that people can do, and there's no way I can do it without showing you. I don't even think I can describe it. But, you know, well, I will. There is one thing that I just wish the whole country would know, and it's a simple thing. You know, if you were to take your thumb and your forefinger and your middle finger and put those three together, you're going to feel a pulse there. But if you do that for just a second, do each of you feel a pulse there or some kind of little beat? Well, that's the alpha state. That is the state of meditation that a lot of times you see saints in pictures. They'll do their fingers that way.
Mm-hmm.
And but you can be aware of that pulse right there. Now let's just say you're a nurse and you're taking someone's pulse rate. You can do the same thing without looking at your watch by putting it on a person's wrist.
Yeah.
And what I want you to do is to put it on their left wrist, because just like the ring finger, the left, that goes directly, you'll know this as a nurse, it'll go directly to the heart. And if you're concentrating on that pulse that is there and putting it on that patient's left wrist, and it works on the right one too, but you put it on the left one, you're going to feel their pulse rate, and they're going to be feeling yours. And if you're in a quiet, meditative state, it's amazing to me. I've seen a lot of hands that were shaking get real still.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And,
okay, that's a good thing.
And
yeah,
I bet you notice that as a nurse, too, whenever you're doing that and taking someone's pulse rate for a brief period of time while you have a hold of them, their arm starts settling into to your rhythm.
Yeah,
and that's
calm right down.
Yeah.
And we talk about that as becoming one with each other. That's a very physical, tangible way you can become one with someone and help them through a difficult time.
That's a good thing to know.
Well, you know what a lot of people also do forget. I was very, very ill. I would say not last February, February 4 last. I was very ill, and this doctor came in. And came in and touched me. It was an Indian doctor, and I don't mean Tano, I mean an Indian doctor, and I know I'm going to get letters. He touched my hand, and he says, "I wish you peace." And I said, "Thank you." And just that putting his hand on me, I felt better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's not, you know, I'm
it's
in a hospital
right,
bed.
If somebody's right, because you can feel, though, that he actually meant what he said, though.
Yeah, you know, there are doctors that come into a room and say, yeah, why are you here? They haven't even looked at the chart. You know, why are you here? And you tell them, and you give them a full thing, and they're like, that's nice, and... I had one doctor, I remember, I was in an emergency room because of a situation. I had gotten into an accident, and I was in a situation. This was about 5 years ago. But the nurse, I'm a diabetic, and I said, my sugar is dropping. Oh, that's nice. Can you take my sugar? And it was 55. I said, I need something to eat. Oh, we don't usually have meals. I said, can somebody go to McDonald's? I'll give you the money.
Yeah.
You know, I need something to eat. I just can't stay in the emergency room, or you might not be finding me there in the morning very well. And suddenly this nurse said, okay. And she took a Lean Cuisine out of the freezer, and she gave me a Lean Cuisine. Because that's all she supposedly had. And I said, thank you. How much do I owe you? She said, don't worry about it. But that's the point. Some people nowadays don't care, and that's what annoys me.
And we hope that they do. And, you know, that's the thing, you know. And, because when I'm sure, Sam, when you are at these hospitals, you see everything. So that's what actually this show is going to be about. And people, you know, when they get used to a show like this going to be on, then hopefully they'll call in and, you know, or like I have, that people have sent in questions, because, you know, sometimes people don't want to ask it over the phone. So if they send in questions, we can absolutely answer, you know, have you answer them, you know, and that will help people, because sometimes you really do want to ask a question and they don't really want to call in. So I think when we do advertise this, I will also say that too, because the person that gave me the questions, you know, that answered, you know, asked questions, that's a good thing, because they really wanted to know, you know. And so that's something we can think of when we do the show. So I think, Sam, also, when you talk to people, if they, you know, want you to talk to them over the over the phone during the show, if they want to email you questions, that might be a good way to communicate, because I do know that people don't want to talk sometimes on the phone. They don't even want to go in the chat room and ask a question. And that's what, we understand that, and I definitely do. So, but they can always, you know, actually they can go always to www.michiganavenuemedia.com, and they can send me an email for, we're going to have the show once a month at the last Tuesday of every month on Tuesday at 9 Eastern. So they can ask the question and listen in, and I'll ask the question for them, you know, because I think some people don't want to. And this is a very tough, touchy subject. So I some people may want to know questions that they wouldn't want to have anybody hear their voice or name. So they will remain nameless, you know, and that will work. Is that okay with you, Sam? I mean, that would be something.
You know what? And I want people to feel free to. To know that no question is taboo, whether it be religious or spiritual, because I've done this long enough to, I've worked with pretty much all the earth religions, the religious institutions, to people who are more metaphysical, to people who are into all kinds of different things, and I've learned over the years not to be. To be judgmental, so that I can learn from each modality of care. Because
that's a good thing. I mean, that's really, not to be judgmental. That's really what it's about. That's what this whole show is about. Because you're not judging them. You're just. That's why if they don't feel comfortable asking it over the phone, then just send it in because we will answer it. And like you're right, because some questions, you know, I don't know if people know this about me. They know I write, but they don't. I worked for doctors for years and years, and I worked in hospitals, and I was in blood banking. I was a laboratory technician, and I worked for hospitals. I did cardiograms. I was everywhere, you know. And so I do know about this, too, you know. And so that's one of the reasons that it's important to get some of these messages and to have people be able to ask questions for you, because I think at that time, and, you know, there's sometimes, unfortunately, it will happen once to them or twice or more than that. They have to know certain things. And maybe, you know, even by what you're saying about the pulse, I think sometimes that people will remember that if they're with a loved one, that will put them in a comfort zone is something that we all want to know, because sometimes we all go, what can we do to, and even though they're not communicating, what can we do to let them know that we're here? And so I think that's something that you just said, can just tell them that we're here for you.
Well, I'm realizing the older I get, just how much power really is in unconditional love. And the first thing I think of is, if you were to walk through a nursing home and know some of those people who have their aches and pains, and then bring in a dog or a cat, and that person may be in a lot of pain, or you bring in a baby, they're some of the greatest healers there are, because for a brief moment of time, that person who's in a lot of pain forgets about their pain and their focus is on the unconditional loving innocence of that child or that dog or that cat.
Well, in the nursing homes, though, they do bring dogs in. They do bring dogs in. I've been there when they've had dogs in, and the older people that are in the nursing homes just love it, and they love being around little kids.
And it
does it for the time being. They don't feel the pain that they're in. You're right. That's a
right.
Good thing.
But the point I want to make is, if we could all learn to live in that unconditional state, that was with each other, that we give to that child and receive back, I wonder how much healing would take place and how much less. We would need medicine in order to sustain ourselves anymore.
Well, I think everybody wants to feel loved. Right. I think what you're saying is right. I mean, this would be a really nice thing if the world could, you know, if people could care about each other just a little bit more than they do, we might feel better about ourselves even also, you know. I think that's a good thing, to care about people.
Well, you know, one of the things that I hear off and on, not a lot, but I hear people, or at least I hear it in the themes of what they're trying to tell me or ask of me when I come to see them as a chaplain. One of the things that I notice a lot is that they're either hoping or they want God to love them just as they are.
Yeah.
No matter what they've done.
Right.
We all want and even have an expectation of our source or God to have an unconditional spirit, giving spirit. And, you know, down deep, I think we know that. We know that because that's what we give oftentimes to a little baby that is brought into
Mark,
the room.
Can I say something real quick?
Yes.
There is a condition called failure to thrive, and babies will actually die if they don't get enough human contact, touch, and held, and, you know, so why wouldn't elderly people, you know, people of any age, you know?
And it's interesting you mentioned
that. I'm a firm believer that touch can heal,
I think you sound like a great. You sound like you were a great nurse. I'll tell you that. You shouldn't have retired. I mean, really.
You
sound like you were.
Well, Sandra is always a great nurse. We know that.
Yeah, but you can hear it. You can tell. You know. I mean, you know, and I, you know, I love what I did when I worked for doctors. I mean, and there are a group of people out there that are good medical people. You know, and Sam knows that too. We all know this because, and you know, those aren't always the ones that shine. The ones you hear about are the ones that are not so good. But the truth of the matter is, there are a lot of good medical people out there. You know, and I think what's happened to the world is we're all so stressed that we say, "Oh, this one's not good and that one," but the truth of the matter is there are good people in hospitals and in nursing homes. I mean, it just may be the ones that, you know, occasionally there's a bad seed and that takes over because sometimes you don't recognize the one that's really nice, but you recognize the one that isn't. So I think that that's what happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also the problem is there was just that lovely nurse's walkout that they had, and the hospital then did a closeout on those nurses because they got all temporaries a few days ago, and there's this big, big dispute going on about that. It's not the idea of let's see what we can do about writing or do about what about nursing. It's the nurses said, "Hey, I'm not going to show up," and it just upsets me.
Well, I'm not speaking up for the nurses that you're talking about. I'm saying, though, but sometimes, and I think that Sandra knows what I'm going to say, they're not treated in the best of ways, nurses.
Nurses usually don't have good health care, and they usually don't have good pay, but most of your best nurses look beyond that, and, you know, they're there for the residents, for the patients.
That's,
you know,
what I say. I would like to believe that, too. And I do think, but there are some that are not that great, but that's in every profession. I think that, you know, and I think, you know, like, right. And I think sometimes, like in Sam, you're also, I think you've said in other times, you know, the family also, you know, if they have issues a lot of times with the person that's in the bed there that's sick, then sometimes the patient and the whole staff, everybody seems like the staff isn't good, but it's the family members that may. Is that true? I mean, you know what I'm saying, Sam? We've talked about that, I think, where the family members are unhappy with the person that's sick, and they're trying to be, you know, like a good child or a good, you know, mother, whatever, and they're not, they're actually mad at the patient that's in there for various other reasons. Because remember we talked about that, about what should a person do?
Yeah.
If they, at the end, if they want to say, if they really want to come to terms.
Yeah, you know, if we were to look through all the veils of what's really going on in all the different roles that people play in the dying process of someone,
right.
If there is anger involved, it's usually the person is angry that the person is dying. Not that that actual person is dying, but that life didn't go the way that they had hoped it would go.
Right.
You see how our children are involved? You know, we're the only country out of all of them that are in the world that actually believes we have an ego, and we have that in our psychological identity as a nation in the United States. You know, all the rest of the countries believe that all is one and they are connected to each other. We're the only country that actually believes we have individualization.
It's an interesting thing.
And it's a wonder people look at us as strange at times as a people, you know, or that we are conceited or have an ego. Well, we do have an ego because we created it.
Yeah.
We created it as a nation. And as psychologically, and if you're going to create something, then it's going to have a life form, and it's going to have an identity. It's going to have a life, And because of that, because that gets involved in the act of dying itself, the ego is oftentimes very disappointed that it, that what it thought was the ultimate in life has to go.
See, and I think the one thing that you said, and I think maybe we can repeat this for like toward the end. This is actually the end of the show, but I think what you said it one other time when you were on the show is that sometimes when people want to be at the bedside of somebody and they are, maybe they didn't have the best relationship with them. I think what you said is like at that particular time, what maybe you can say what you think is necessary. What do they do if, you know, at that time when they, instead of telling them how sorry they are about everything they did, what do you think the patient needs? Because I think you've mentioned that before.
Well, if they're cognitive enough to say they're sorry, they need to have the opportunity to do that. But you know what? Most patients are so weak when it gets to the end of their life that they don't have the energy to do it.
Right.
What my hope is for people is that everyone recognizes that we do have a human nature that is not perfect. And we've done good things in the world and we've done bad things. But, you know, I've said this, I think, on one of your shows before.
Yeah, I love that. I think that made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I really believe we're here to give and receive unconditional love. Yeah. Think about that for a moment. If you believe in God, source, universe, I don't care what you call that part of that brings into the world and takes out of the world and moves in and through us that we often call spirit or soul, if we're going to become one with God or become godlike, like a lot of people strive for in their life, you're going to have to learn a little bit about unconditional love. Because I guarantee you that if we are going to become one with God, we're going to have to learn that a little bit. Because I am certain there's a lot of laughter that goes on with the ultimate of God or whatever you want to call that part of us that knows that how we play out our lives is never going to be perfect, but it becomes perfect love when you add relationships around us, surrounding us, to create us or recreate us or shape us up to help us to become who we're meant to be. When you use the whole human race and collectively bring us all together, hopefully we get to a place where our focus can be in a place within our heart where we can give and receive unconditional love with each other. Because in the end, it's the only thing that will save the soul and give the soul hope in any kind of life beyond death itself.
Thank you. I think that's...
Do you remember Norman Cousins' Anatomy of an Illness, Sam?
Yes, I know.
Yeah, I've read that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hear the same kind of thing that Norman Cousins said many years ago. We have to have laughter in death and in life. You know, I always remembered he was feeling ill and he watched the Marx Brothers and thought about the Marx Brothers and redid his blood pressure and everything else and it went down. And that's the same thing in death. Sometimes I said, if I'm going to die, somebody just give me a bunch of Mel Brooks and Jerry Lewis and let me go happy.
Well, I think that's a good thing to leave. I mean, because the truth of the matter, these are questions, these are things that people don't always talk about. That's why I think the show will be very good, because I think that there are a lot of questions that people have, because it's, you know, this is a part of life that we have to all go through, unfortunately, with people that we love. So I think that, Sam, I think that, you know, I want you to give your website, so in case they want to go to your website and see all the other things that you've talked about, you know, in various events you've done.
Well, you can go to my website. It's called, it's pathintohealing.com. The title of it is Healing Care Resources. If you were to type that in on Google, it should show up on the first spot there on the web. There's a lot of free articles, and, of course, my books are on there. There's a blog site that you can go to. You can follow me on Facebook. I have reached my limits now, and I have created an author page. I'm also on Google Plus. That has really become
yes, the Google Plus seems to be something else. So you mean, so you're saying, so on Facebook, see, I don't know what's going on with Facebook, and I don't think very many, I mean, it's changing probably like as we speak right now. I mean, you know,
yes.
And that's the problem. It keeps changing, and every time you do something, then it changes more. So I've noticed a lot of people, Sandra and I were talking about this, that are, I've noticed people, I don't even know who they are now. They're on my Facebook, they're coming up, and I don't see the other people. So and I think what people are probably having to do is like, which I did tonight, and I did, I guess it worked, because I think, Bennett, you have not seen a lot of my emails.
No, I haven't. You sent me an email, and I popped in.
Right. So I think what's happening now is people are starting to use email again. I am, because, and I talked to Sandra about that, so this way, at least you know they get it. Because I think now we're not knowing if it's going to be on, if the people on Facebook that were our friends are even getting anything that we did.
Well, I will say this. We have a show October 11th. I did want to make a quick plug on our show on October. It's a horrible night of radio. So we're going to have some horror guests, some horror authors.
I did put that out. I put it out yesterday just in about the blog talk, but you're right. It's October. I can't, you know, for me it seems like September flew by, and it's now going to be October. It just goes by so fast. I mean,
and Sam, you're welcome to join us if you'd like to.
She will be there. I think she will be there. I think she's good.
No, Sam.
Oh, Sam. Sam is going to be a lot of time.
Yeah, I need somebody religious on the other side to protect me from the horror authors who are going to stake me.
I think Sam is probably busy, to be honest.
Sam is very busy. I read his poetry, and I it's the first time I've got to really talk to the man, and I really enjoy him.
Yeah, because Sam will be.
You notice I was almost half quiet during most of the show, Marcia.
Yeah, I know. I know that you actually. I wasn't going to say anything, but yes, you were. Right?
Sam is amazing. Yes, you said before he is.
Yeah, he is. No, he really
now
is.
Now he's blushing, but it's all right.
No, he's very comforting. He really is. And so I will send you his address. I'll give you, Sam, your address when I get to work tomorrow, and I will, and he'll send you his books.
I would love to see them.
You know, because Sam, I want to thank you, and I think that we got some of these questions out, and then we'll have more in a month, I'm sure, because now people will know what we're going to be doing. And so, I will, you know, and we'll do as we do, talk. And so, Sam, thank you very much, and have a good night. And we appreciate
you too.
And Bennett, thank you for joining us.
Always.
Sandra?
Mm-hmm. I'm here.
Uh-huh, there you go. Sandra will be on next Tuesday. And like Virginia and I talk about that, we don't exactly know where I'm going to be, but I'm usually on Blog Talk, seems like, every day. I find a new subject that's very interesting. So I think, you know, and Sam is great. I mean, he really is. You know, and Bennett, you're right. You were very still. I'm surprised.
Well, I enjoyed him immensely.
Yeah, he's very interesting. And he's very calm.
And I will say that to his face. I'll say it behind his back.
I really enjoyed
what Sam did and everything else.
Yeah,
now, I'm going to excuse myself, Marcia.
Yes,
I will talk
night.
To you on the 11th.
Yes. Good night. Yes.
And hopefully I'll talk to you sooner on other things, but that's beside the point. Be well, everybody.
Okay, all right, you too.
Bye, you too.
Bye-bye. Bye. Sandra, thank you so much. And there we go. So we'll sign out for tonight and say thank you to everybody. And I'll be on at Friday at noontime with Virginia. Have a nice night.
You too.
Bye. Bye-bye.